Welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by the Growth Platform Framework. B2B FinTech startups accelerate customer acquisition and set up business operations to scale systematically. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@ipractitioners.com. Now, over to the show with Richard Dosey, founder and host. Hey, what's up, everyone? Today in the show, we have Bilal, co-founder and CEO of Equisafe. Hey, Bilal, how's it going today out in Paris?
Hi, Richard. Thank you for having me. I'm doing great. And it's actually a sunny day today in Paris.
Awesome. And let's kick off the show with you just giving us a bit of a background about yourself.
Sure. Today, I'm 29 years old. I'm actually a French scientist initially. I graduated in fundamental physics and applied mathematics. I was basically, really in physics and mathematics. I've done some research. I was wondering maybe I would start a PhD. After the research moment I had, I decided to go and live kind of the expatriate life in the Middle East. So I worked in Abu Dhabi for a little bit more than a year in a company specialized in renewable energies. And there I was basically doing studies on the impact of specific policies which are supposed to foster the energetic transition. And basically, I was using mathematical models to try to predict what are going to be those impacts of those policies within the economy of a specific country. And I worked on countries in the region of Middle East and also in South America. And there, basically, I started to get very much interested in finance and economy and trying to get a step back on all the technical skills that I had and trying to understand how they could be applied to create value globally, I would prefer. And so then after that experience, I went back to school, where in a business school called the ESCP Europe in Paris, and I basically studied management with a specialization in finance and entrepreneurship. After that graduation, I basically worked as a freelance consultant for an investment bank called Edmond de Rothschild, where I worked on market infrastructure for private equity funds. And after this mission, that's where I had the idea of Equisafe, and we'll be able to get back to it during the talk. But basically, that's where I got the idea of Equisafe. And after this experience in this investment bank, I went to a consulting firm called Accenture, and I worked there for a year as a strategy consultant, trying to build at the same time kind of the value proposition and the vision and the roadmap of Equisafe. And about a year afterward, in January 2019, I quitted my job and I co-founded Equisafe with Frédéric, which I met at Edmond de Rothschild back a year ago. And we've been both working on the Equisafe project. The interesting thing is that he also have a double background because he was a lawyer, an M&A lawyer in real estate. And then he also did a computer science master's. And when I was working at Accenture, he was working at EY as the lawyer coder of the blockchain lab. And basically, that's a little bit of my background. And it's been now a little bit more than 2 years that I've been working on Equisafe. And I'll have time to get back on Equisafe.
Okay, awesome. And that's a nice segue into the Equisafe journey. And just so we can paint the picture for everyone, I mean, you just alluded to how that idea came about when you're working for the private equity company. Can you run us through what actually happened, what transpired, and how that idea came to fruition?
Sure. So my mission at Rothschild was basically to work on digital private equity. So for what it's worth, I was supposed to define what was digital private equity, try to map a strategy of implementation, and basically in order to improve transaction processes and all the back office processes, specifically on compliance and administrative tasks, very time consuming, very low value added, and subject to a lot of mistakes because it's usually human who give information to other humans. And so anytime you can miss a paper, you cannot read what's written, not understand what's written, et cetera, et cetera. And in terms of transaction process and private equity, before you do an investment, you basically have to do a due diligence. And we found out in terms of corporate law that the structures where we were investing had very minimum audit trail, which didn't help to the due diligence process, which couldn't then accelerate the transaction process. And it was my mission to accelerate the transaction process. And so here's what I was called to do at Rothschild. And basically, when I was there, I was talking with some interns, and I saw a couple of interns. They were reading a newspaper of a countryside city in France. I said, okay, guys, what are you doing in reading this newspaper of this small city of 100,000 living people there? And they told me, yeah, you know, private markets, and at the difference of public markets, they don't have requirements to publish income statements and information on the company. So it's actually very hard for us to source potential investment. I said, okay, if I want to speed up the transaction process, the first thing that I could do is to accelerate the sourcing process. So we've built in there at Rothschild a software that automates basically the deal sourcing of private equity funds using a lot of data. And so basically I was getting data from a lot of different databases. I was matching that with data from and profile on both the CEOs of the companies and the companies through LinkedIn. I was doing some sentiment analysis on articles that were published on this company, on the newspaper, on internet. And basically I built this kind of model that would score a company depending on multiple different variables. And so then they invested in 6 of the 10 companies that software sourced. At that time, we were basically, it was just before the RGDP. And basically when the RGDP went in, I was not able anymore to scrap data as easily in order to run my software. And that's basically the time where I left Rothschild, went to Accenture, and kept on brainstorming on how we could foster the transaction processes. So the idea came just by seeing interns reading a newspaper that I wouldn't expect them to read. And then I met Frédéric, and with his legal background, we basically understood that if we wanted to improve the sourcing of companies, we needed to digitize all the audit trail that are linked to the corporate side of the company. And that's with him where we basically decided to use blockchain to digitize shareholder registries and build a one-stop shop platform to facilitate transaction using enablers such as the implementation of electronic governance and electronic transfer rights to basically tomorrow power the next generation marketplace for private securities. And by doing so, we believe that the transparent ownership that it will bring, the automated legal processes, they will be the cornerstone to improve the investment of experience of any type of investor. And yeah, so basically that's how we started building a bunch of legal tech products in order to manage the equity, to manage distribution of different instruments, like for example, warrants. And we built the rest of the platform that helps with digital subscription when you're doing a fundraising, or for example, implementing digital governance. By this, I mean implementing dematerialized general meeting in order to be able to interact with the investor and to follow the governance of the company invested.
Cool. And I mean, you clearly understood the problem. You came up with a pretty cool solution to maybe an area that hadn't been disrupted or an area that hadn't had that technology push into it. I guess that the next part of it is playing around with the product and validating it. And what process did you go through to make certain that your product actually did fit the market needs at that point in time?
So two elements. First, just to give you a notice, today most private investments are still managed the same way. Most of the shareholder registry are maintained on Excel. You interact with the company using email. Some of them even run general meetings by email, and they basically spend a lot of time reporting to the investors, doing PowerPoint presentation as the tool to track their ownership. And we believe the investment experience is very poor and sometimes even depressing. That's basically where we want to stand. To get a little bit technical, we've created a modular yet standardized set of smart contracts called the NIC standard, replicating shareholder registry and corporate and securities compliance that are built in within the code. That allows us to improve transaction speed while optimizing administrative and compliance costs. If I can give a concrete example about it, in 2019, we enhanced the sale of a luxurious Parisian hotel by reducing the cost of the transaction by almost 60% while doing the administrative work in 30 minutes instead of a month. So here in a real estate transaction, you have the notaries of both parties, the lawyers of both parties, valuation companies, and all those people work in silos and they don't have a tool to collaborate efficiently. And that's what we provide. And within those tools, there is electronic signature, there is a smart contract using the Tezos blockchain, et cetera, et cetera. And more importantly, shares were actually sold at 6.5 euros. What it means is that anyone, anywhere was able to buy a piece of this marvelous mansion. And that's the capabilities of blockchain technology, basically managing 10 investors or 1 million investors the same way. To answer your second question about the process I went through to achieve product market fit, it's both intuition and co-construction with the client. Because in the beginning, when you start your company, you don't have product market fit, you just have an idea, an intuition, a direction you need to follow. And we started like that, and we started challenging people to try to understand what could be our clients. Because of course there are multiple targets, and the idea is to prioritize those targets in order to maximize minimize your sales cycle and maximize your growth, right? And so we started with this intuition of saying, okay, there is definitely a need to improve the investment experience. To do that, there are multiple layers, both technical, legal, financial. And we basically went to see almost 500 people in maybe 1 year to basically challenge the needs. And also what every entrepreneur should do is basically close doors. People think that they're supposed to open doors. No, you have an infinite possibility. Possibilities, and you're supposed to close doors. And so I basically went to people and tried to close the doors and see what kind of targeted clients best fit the vision that we had on building this software. And as I would say, is both delivering what the clients want, getting more intuition to build the next feature by understanding what they could do next. And that's basically the strategy that we've done. When we've done Anna, which was the first transaction that I've just mentioned, before in January 2019, people basically needed a digital subscription funnel that reconciliates both financial flux with the securities movement. So that was the first version of the product. And then came another company and they said, okay, we could extend this product to basically organize a closing between two investors within the platform. And we said, okay, it's another operation that can mutate the shareholder registry doing an asset transfer. So we've done the capital increase with digital subscription. Now let's go to the second operation, which was the asset transfer. And then once we were able to do that, people came and said, okay, now that these investors and I'm able to calculate very accurately my cap table in order to know instantly how much dividend I'm supposed to send to each of my investors, can you guys build in a dividend distribution product? And then we said, okay, so we're starting to have a lot of functionalities in handling the capital of a company, but the equity of a company. But actually, when you become a shareholder, you might need to vote in a general meeting or participate in some kind of governance. And so we had to add up this consultation or governance functionalities in order to both complement the product and address the clients, with the idea that feature will be reusable by other clients. So it's in adequation with our roadmap. So yeah, it's a balance between intuition, the client's response, and your technical roadmap.
I like your roundup at the back end there. I mean, it sounds like you went through quite a deep process. I mean, speaking to 500 people in a year, that's pretty impressive. But you went through a deep process to make certain you spoke to your customers, understood exactly what their needs and wants were and also their problems. Then you iterated your product off the back of that if it needed to be iterated. And you continued along that development cycle.
Exactly. Doing hypotheses, trying to confirm those hypotheses, and mostly trying to learn which hypotheses are wrong. That's the most important.
Good point there. And as you moved out of that phase of product market fit and you started, you know, having to think about building up your business and your teams, what has been your philosophy to building up or scaling up your business and your teams?
So our main philosophy is about democratizing investment opportunities. Why do I say that? I say that because blockchain, everybody says it's bringing the Internet of Value, but nobody really understands what's the Internet of Value. And if I take the first internet, which was about exchanging information, it means basically we're able to exchange information through an SMS or a WhatsApp message instantly. And the important word is instantly, because we're already able to share information. As today, we're already able to share value, but we're not able to run a valuable transaction instantly. And that's basically what's being allowed with blockchain technology. And if I can go deeper, there is three components to this democratizing investment. The first component is a technological component. It's about using a new technology of distributed database to reinvent or rebuild a more efficient market infrastructure. Once you have that market infrastructure, so it's basically the pillar of the platform, you're able to create new use, new experience, and new access. Why that? Like I was saying, with blockchain technology, you're able to manage 10 investors or 100,000 investors the same way. So on top of this market infrastructure, which is the technological component, you have kind of a social component where by allowing a company to manage more investors, you're actually lowering the barriers to entry because each shares will be less expensive. Just as we've fractionalized the real estate asset in 1 million pieces of shares, and so one share was 6.5 euro. So anyone, anywhere, was able to buy a piece of this marvelous mansion. And then the third component is, so I was saying the first is market infrastructure. The second one is basically the primary market where you're lowering the barriers to entry. And the second one is by implementing those electronic transfer rights and governance, you're basically able to automate the rules on which a transaction can happen or not. And by those rules, I mean corporate rules or securities restrictions. For example, you have a lockup period, you cannot sell your securities. We basically encode this lockup so that when you try to sell your securities, it will automatically block you if you're in a lockup period, or allows you if the transaction is eligible to the shareholder registry, to the shareholder agreement, or the securities law. And bringing this automation really speeds up the transaction process and allows us to build, like I was saying, the next generation marketplace where we'll be able to exchange instantly financial instruments from private companies or just private securities in a general matter.
That's some great detail there. I mean, I love those sort of three components that you dove into there. And if you take a look at your business, you know, you guys are two and a bit years old now. When you first started out, I mean, and I guess through the journey, what have you done to prioritize the internal processes and systems that you need to set up in order to grow? So have you looked at maybe making certain that your marketing and sales department was developed alongside your dev guys? Or how have you guys looked at that?
So there are many ways to do it. The first one is to structure a very clear sales process. It sounds easy, but it's definitely not. It depends on your business model. It depends on your clients. And it depends on your acquisition strategy. So it's definitely not as easy as it sounds, the first cornerstone if you want to scale. Then how do you scale? In order to scale, so for us, I'll speak about us. We are a SaaS B2B platform. And so the first thing that we have to do if we want to scale is to implement internal payment within the platform, which was not the case until today. We were basically doing a separate contract outside the platform, billing the person, and then onboarding it, which is not a good scaling process. And this is why we've been working on that part lately, because there are more problems to that. If you haven't integrated the payment within the platform, not only you cannot scale, but also it creates a lot of complexity because sometimes, so in our case, real estate managers can manage multiple real estate portfolios. Some of them are created, some of them are finished. And it creates a latency when you haven't implemented the payment within the platform. And the latency basically means that the client paid 1 month that he didn't obviously use the platform. Because basically it took us the time afterwards to onboard the person, to form her, etc. So it really think about what scaling means, how you can optimize this scaling process, and always based on feedback, which is basically the most important. You know nothing. Even though you're the CEO of your company, you know nothing. So just start from this standpoint. So the clients, they're not hard with you if you're transparent. So if you listen to feedbacks and you say, okay, I'm gonna implement that. I'm sorry, I didn't understood. The clients will value you more, even though you're late in the delivery, than if you get in kind of a conflicted path where you say, yeah, I'm sorry, but that's basically my vision. Either you get in or you get out. But your vision is not something crystal clear in the beginning. That basically becomes more and more net as you grow in your entrepreneur journey.
I love what you're saying there. I think if I was to sort of sum it up, you got to be adaptable and take feedback, not as a criticism, but as a bit of information to improve, right?
Exactly. It's something that you missed, the feedback. It's not something that you're wrong about. I just wanted to share some of my experience. And there's something else that I want to share because I think it's important in terms to support growth. It's about strategy. A lot of people don't understand what strategy means. They think strategy is knowing basically where you need to go, but a strategy, it's not just only, it's more about the journey than where you want to go. And it's more about asking yourself each time, am I on the right path? And emit hypotheses to support if you're on the right path or not. And that's a strategy.
You touch on such an interesting topic there. I mean, I get the strategy is about, you know, us as entrepreneurs being on a journey. How have you and your co-founder, how have you held yourself to account to make certain that, you know, there's movement forward on a continuous basis?
So we've implemented metrics like most of the startup, like basic SaaS B2B metrics, for example, churn, for example, cost of acquisition, customer lifetime value. But this becomes more and more interesting when you have like more than 1,000 clients. Right now, since we had to build a whole market infrastructure, we basically have more and more clients, but we spend like maybe 1 year with 3 clients trying to co-build the product, as we were saying in the beginning of the podcast. And right now, the intermediaries metrics that we are following is mostly cost of acquisition, which is a very important metric. And basically, our cost of acquisition is decreasing by 20% for the past 4 months. And another one is, which is interesting because our business model is proportional to the number of investors. So it's important to track the number of investors that are on the platform because the company pays for the number of investors that she's allowing in her cap table. And there is another metric that is interesting, but which is not linked to our business model, but still it's an interesting metric. It's the net asset value of the assets that are managed on Equisafe. And so just to give our KPIs, we basically decreased from a 20K customer acquisition cost to a 7.5K customer acquisition cost within the last 4 months. We went from 15 clients to almost 50 clients, and we have like a 30% growth within the last 2 months. And the last one is the net asset value that you have within the platform. We've just reached 230 million of assets under, I don't like to say management because we're not an asset manager. So I prefer to say asset under administration because those asset managers, they administrate those assets with our platform. And we have more than 3,000 investors right now on the platform. So it's very encouraging. And yeah, being able to build metrics, it's really not easy in the beginning. You're like, okay, I'm a SaaS B2B, I'm supposed to implement all those metrics. I don't understand half of them. So it's definitely not easy and it takes time and it takes experience and more clients in order to understand your exact sales process, your exact persona, the model that you want to replicate. So if I could give just an advice, don't be afraid, just stay calm and review everything in your mind, everything that seems odd, don't leave it. Just try to understand why you think it's odd and to solve the problem.
Yeah, some sage advice there. And we've spoken about sort of a lot of the sort of the business side of things and also some of the technical and system side of things. And I mean, I guess a large part of any business is the people and the talent that we bring into our startups or scale-ups. And how have you as a CEO and a co-founder, how have you approached building that talented team?
That's a very good question, because each time someone asks me what's the most complicated thing I found as an entrepreneur, I always say two things. The first one is pricing. Super hard to determine and pricing, because everyone has a different background, has different views on how it could implement. And so it's a rope that is pulling you in every direction. So it's very complicated to define the right pricing. And secondly, is about the human capital. It's about recruiting. And I also find that it's probably the most difficult thing that you could do as an entrepreneur, specifically when you're young and you don't have a lot of experience. And the experience comes in two ways. The first, the experience of doing recruitment, and two, the experience of managing human. And when you're young, you tend to be too nice. You tend to give too much benefit of the doubt to the person because he took the time and selected you as a company and he wants to work with you, et cetera, et cetera. What I would recommend on that is to really let experts doing their job, because we had a couple of missed experience while recruiting. And now we externalize that to one of our investors, who basically did 2,000 recruitments in 5 years. So yeah, don't be afraid to ask for help and to reach for the right person for implementing one of your strategies. And here it's human capital and recruiting. So it's very hard. We had a lot of turnover in the beginning. Also, when you're an entrepreneur in the beginning, you're super excited. You want to go quick. You think you have the momentum, and don't lure yourself and stay your feet on the ground. And yeah, that's it.
Being an entrepreneur, you also have to, at some point in time, make the decision and also then acknowledge that you need to bring in experts to help you, because we don't know it all. So I think it's great that you acknowledge that you tried out and you got a result. Maybe it wasn't the exact result you guys are looking for. So you brought an expert, and now I'm sure the process is, it sounds like it's much better, and you're sort of moving towards what you want to move towards.
Exactly.
Cool. And listen, I mean, as you guys go forward and as you look towards the future, what questions are you starting to ask yourself and factors are you considering as you continue on that growth trajectory?
So one of the questions I'm asking myself is, for example, like I was saying earlier, when you're starting, you're supposed to minimize your sales cycle in order to maximize the number of clients that you can onboard on the platform. That's for two reasons. The first one is that those short sales cycle clients will give you feedback, will give you KPIs in order to address bigger clients. And the question I'm asking myself is, when do I stop targeting those clients and I try the next level, basically? And I don't mean I'm going to stop reaching out for those small sales cycle clients. I'm just saying, me as the CEO, my time is extremely valuable. And should I stop spending it on some longer sales cycle, leveraging basically the KPIs that we have and the users that we have? When should I do that? Because in the beginning, when I was basically knocking at every door, trying to close possibilities, clients that have a longer sales cycle, they told me, okay, come back in 1 year. And it's like 9 months since those people told me, come back in 1 year. So I'm starting to wonder, okay, should I knock back to their door 1 year later? I'll probably do. But yeah, you have to navigate between basically your investors saying, okay, you need to sign clients, and have cash flows. And on the other side, you have you as the CEO trying to disrupt the market, being extremely ambitious. And yeah, you have to balance between your ambition and your readiness and be very lucid about it. Basically, in 3 months, when the year is over, I'm going to go back to see this client and I'll directly see if this client was serious, or if he tells me come back in 1 year again. And basically, if he tells me basically come back in 1 year, I'll understand that we're not yet ready and I'll try back maybe in 6 months and keep doing what we were doing. So when do I get to the next sale of acquisition of customer? That's my question right now. Other question that I have is, there is another thing that is very hard, is that when you're young and you're building a company, people you're working with, they tend to become or want to become your friends. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but what is bad is when they think because they're your friend that they will be, how can I say, they'll be protected, meaning I'll choose them before the company, which is extremely naive and completely false. And as an entrepreneur, you need to be very transparent and direct with those people, saying, okay, we can be friends, we can work together. But when the time comes, always choose Equisafe, even before me. And I usually say to my guys, nobody is irreplaceable, even me. I have no experience to get a company from 100 people to 1,000 people. So I'm very lucid about it. And I say, if I reach 100 people, I'll definitely find another CEO to grow the company while I learn. And then if everything goes well, I'll get back to my position. But I'm definitely ready to step down if it's in the best interest of the company.
I mean, some valuable insights there. I think it's a case of, you know, you, as you say, creating that transparency, but also, you know, setting the right boundaries so everyone sort of pushes in the right direction.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really linked to growth, because when you'll have an HR problem, it will definitely log down your growth, both in terms of investment, both in terms of, it's very time consuming. And it's time you're not allocating to your clients or prospects.
Yeah. As an entrepreneur, I know I like to read and continue our learning journey, put it that way. And I was wondering if you, in the recent past, have finished up a good book or currently reading a good book that you'd like to share with the community.
Yeah, sure. And thank you for asking the question, because to be honest with you, it's been like maybe 5 years that I didn't read a romance book. By romance, I mean a story,
academic book. Okay.
And I was only reading academic books. If I could recommend one academic book which I really love so much, it's called Digital Transformation Playbook. And the author is David L. Rogers. He's a professor at Columbia. The book is a poetry. I mean, really, I had a revelation at each sentence. I understood something new at each sentence, really. So I definitely recommend that. And it's been 2 months that I've joined this reading group here in France, which is called Longue. And I actually read 2 non-academic books lately. The first one is The Chess Player by Stefan Zweig. It's actually very known. But what's interesting about this book, it really talks about the human brain and how the human brain evolves with the external stress that is around you. And specifically at that moment where you manage 13 people, 14 people, you're doing your fundraising, you have like 50 clients that are waiting for you. I felt myself a little bit stressed, and I wanted to understand how those external information were impacting me. And there is another book that I just finished, which is a marvelous book. It's the autobiography of Jackie Chan. So everybody knows Jackie Chan, but actually nobody knows Jackie Chan. And what I love about his book, which is called Don't Grow Up, it's about never taking yourself too seriously. It's about understanding how success can be negative on your health and your body. Basically, try to understand your ego in order not to burn your wings. And it's a marvelous book. And we've all seen Jackie Chan movie. We've all laughed. I think we all liked it. And there is a marvelous person behind the personage.
Awesome shares there. And listen, before we kicked off the podcast today, you had some exciting news. And I don't know if you want to share it with everyone.
Yeah, sure. So yesterday, we were finalists of the MIPIM of New York. So MIPIM is this world-leading real estate exhibitions in the world. The most known exhibition of MIPIM is the one in Cannes in south of France. which is kind of the, you know, the Festival of Cannes, which is the festival of movies. Basically, this is the festival of real estate in the same place. And there is a subsidiary in New York, organized the Museum of New York. And we were finalists among more than 500 companies. We were selected finalists among 500 companies. And so yesterday we pitched, and we won the competition. And so we'll have a keynote at the Museum of Cannes next June, which is definitely a game changer for us. As I was saying, it's like the Festival of Cannes for real estate, or the World Economic Forum for real estate industry. So that's a huge news. And yeah, that was yesterday night at midnight local time here. So we woke up in a very, very good mood. And basically it comes at the right moment, because it's confirming our huge traction and all those positive signals that we're sending to the market in terms of number of clients, in terms of innovation, because we're going to launch the first private secondary market for private securities using blockchain in Europe. And we're gonna inaugurate that with the first trade on a 100 million portfolio. It's really gonna be dope. So stay tuned.
Amazing news, and a real big congratulations to you and your team. I mean, absolutely amazing achievement. Listen, and as we wrap up the show, how can people find and connect with you guys?
So my name is Bilal El Alami with a Y in the end. You can find me on LinkedIn or on Twitter. Just type down Bilal El Alami. You can check out our website, which is equisafe.io, or directly our platform, which is app.equisafe.io. And yeah, feel free to reach out either on LinkedIn or on Facebook, or follow our company page. And yeah, feel free to reach out. I try to respond to everyone. So if you have questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Brilliant. And listen, thanks for coming on the show today. I've really enjoyed the discussion and looking forward to seeing you guys grow really fast in the coming years.
You're welcome, Richard. Thank you for the invitation again. I wish you the best of luck in your journey.